We actually have a couple of legal experts in the next panel. You were hearing that we were calling for that gap. And I also wanted to thank Kerry for his keynote. I think the role of a keynote is really to launch the thought and discussion. It's to lift the veil on a subject and explain how some of the complexities of the subject. And to be honest, it's to be provocative enough to really provoke some discussion and thought. And we're seeing that, and I'm really excited about it. So I'd like to invite the panel up now. This is our first panel on academic freedom and the individual. Feel free to walk behind me and make some noise. We're also going to bring a few more chairs in the back because I know it's difficult for people with their back to the podium just to see what's going on. And I'd like to introduce our moderator for the first panel. We were delighted that Robert Leckie agreed to come. There's actually another conference going on simultaneously, and he agreed to come to moderate this panel. Robert Leckie is associate professor in the Faculty of Law. He's an expert on family and constitutional law, and we are delighted to have him as the moderator.
Thank you very much, Natalie. It's an honor to be here acting as moderator. In your first panel this afternoon, Academic Freedom and the Individual, this panel, all the speakers are from outside McGill and have graciously joined us. And the second panel, there'll be some inside McGill voices. Now, as you're well aware, it's a full schedule for this afternoon, and I've been asked to stick aggressively to the timeline, to be ruthless in keeping time. The panelists will speak for 5 to 7 minutes each, and then we'll have discussion with the audience. And I'm going to keep to the time so that we really do have a chance to have a serious discussion between the audience and the panelists. My introductions will be very brief. More information about each of the speakers is available on the website associated with the conference. I will give the panelists 2 minute, 1 minute, and zero cards when the time comes. And I'll just briefly introduce them. We're going to go in the order printed in the program. Natalie Desrosiers is General Counsel for the Canadian Civil Liberties Association, Professor of Law at the University of Ottawa, a former Dean of the Civil Law Section, a former President of the Law Commission of Canada. It's a great honor to have Natalie with us. Rush Miller is the Hillman University Librarian and Director of the University Library System at the University of Pittsburgh. He's had an active role championing the global accessibility to information, in particular resources from China. Michael Hawes is the CEO of Fulbright Canada and has been a tireless advocate of international education, based in the Department of International Relations at Queen's University. And Vilma Paez is a professor of foreign languages at the Universidad de Holguín in Cuba. She's the director of the Canadian Studies Center there, and so is familiar with Canadian issues in a number of respects. Natalie Desrosiers for 5 to 7 minutes.
Thank you for the invitation. It is Irving Layton, the Canadian poet, who said, "Only the tiniest fraction of mankind want freedom. All the rest want someone to tell them they are free." This appears sometimes somewhat apt in the context of academic freedom, where the intellectual case for it is indisputable, but its iteration application is often surprisingly controversial. I will make 6 brief points. It's not enough to proclaim a right to academic freedom. I will speak, obviously, from the perspective of freedom more than academic. You deserve to have the exercise, and you must have creating institution, incentives, reflexes to ensure that the right is being carried out. Rights are not enough. Second point, academic freedom is certainly a foundational principle of universities and of our collective life. It has broad implication that must be reflected throughout. It is difficult to imagine academic freedom. It is impossible to speak about freedom without looking at participatory rights, to look at the integrity of the research enterprise. So academic freedom must engage with the being protected and ensuring the integrity of research and researchers. It is also linked to teaching, the ability to present one's perspective in class. Academic freedom is linked to the relationship between the university and its employees generally, and to echo with the comment that was made earlier, even in my submission, in a way, academic freedom should give more freedom than what freedom of expression actually confers to individuals. So the duty of loyalty that was evoked in the civil code and that exists also at common law, but in labor law, between employers and employees, which indeed continues to be challenged from a freedom of expression expertise, must be framed differently in the university context. And certainly the loyalty is to the academic mission and not to the employer. Academic freedom frames the rapport with the students. It ensures a respect for their expressive freedom and their freedom to criticize. We've recently been involved in a case in Alberta about that. And academic freedom also must protect generally the exercise of freedom of speech on campus. The university must be there as being at the forefront of the right to hear controversial views. So institutional reflexes to foster academic freedom must be grounded in a theory and a reflection. What does it mean to fight for freedom? And it means to be particularly concerned about the chill. And the way in which we know from doing freedom of expression work, these are the things that you have to worry about. You should always worry. So the chill on expression, the chill on academic freedom is not the direct impact, it's not only the direct impact on the person that is silenced, chastised, threatened to be fired, disciplined, whatever. It is the unspoken impact on others who are watching, who may tend thereafter to hesitate in their criticism, to exercise prior restraints, and so on. So what we know about freedom of expression is that prior restraints are always suspect. We also particularly want to any form of retaliatory action is suspect. Threats, comments from above, official disapproval, all of this is part of it, needs to be looked at. Any form of pre-authorization is also suspect. Any form of control over the form of expression is also to be suspect and examined. You know, when people say, oh, it's good to have expression, but only if it's in a form that's non-anonymous, must be signed, must be in writing, must be polite, it must be non-inflammatory. All of these, I think, should raise alarms as to whether we are indeed imposing a chill. There is a cost to freedom. That's my fourth point. The presumption of innocence in Canada and elsewhere in the world means that, which is a freedom from oppressive coercion from government, does mean that we are supposed to be willing to see 10 people go free even though they're guilty. So there is a cost if you are serious about academic freedom. It will mean that you'll have to tolerate some unrest. It's difficult for Canadians sometimes to accept this. You know, we have peace, order, and good government, but it's part of it. You know, it's part of the acceptance that indeed, if you believe in freedom, then you will be able. You will have to tolerate that there will be some disturbance. So in a way, I think in Canada we also have this sort of nice phrasing that there's no absolute freedom in Canada. There's always reasonable limits that can be imposed. Nevertheless, in the context of freedom of expression, and particularly in the context, I would submit, of academic freedom, the threshold must be extremely high. If there are going to be time and place restrictions, they must be in a way that keep in mind that the protection of academic freedom is essential to the debate. So my final point, institutional responsibility. Rights are not enough. You need to have an institution, a culture that creates a buy-in for the rights, buy-in for the expression. So you need to have proper appeals, you need to have complaints mechanism that makes sense, you need to also have a proactive dimension. It's not enough to have, you have to train your employees, your security employees, in a way that they recognize the value of academic freedom. And finally, I think you need to have proper monitoring, because freedom is fragile, And our reflexes to prevent disturbances are so great. Leighton, if he was here, would say, obviously it's the unpopular speech that needs protection. If we all agree, we don't need protection, you know? So in a way, the tendency when you are faced with unpopular speech is to do the popular thing and to act firmly. So it's very dangerous, in a way, to leave a gap in our ways, in our reflexes. So I will just end on that conclusions. We all want academic freedom. We want not only to say it, we want to live it, we want to exercise it, and that does demand that indeed we create the proper environment for it. Merci beaucoup.
Thank you so much, Natalie. Rush.
I feel a little out of place being the only administrator on the panel, but I'll try. I love being in this room. It reminds me of a library reading room. Perhaps it should be a library reading room. Without academic freedom, universities would be subject to political pressure of politicians, trustees, and others. They would not be free to determine their curriculum or hire the faculty they wish to hire, but faculty members, more importantly, would not be free to engage in unfettered research to advance knowledge. How does this relate to libraries? What's the library perspective on this? Traditionally, I mean, it's a total impact on libraries. The traditional role of a library in a university is to preserve knowledge and to make it available, and to preserve knowledge in all forms, in all types, with all perspectives. The American Library Association recognized this years ago and passed something called the Bill of Rights, the Library Bill of Rights, I'm sorry, for librarians and libraries, addressing the importance of intellectual freedom for both collections and services. Almost every library in the United States has endorsed this. Many of us used to publish it on the walls. And these principles include the right to privacy for library users, the responsibility that selectors and librarians have in building a collection to represent multiple points of view and perspectives, and not let their personal opinions or their personal biases or even their personal values interfere with that selection and impose their values on the rest of the academy. And of course, unfiltered access to the internet and a service philosophy that is emphasizes equality in all user populations. But in practice, this isn't always followed. I've known librarians in my long career of being a library director that impose their personal perspectives on collections. I remember one, when I first became a library director, I was in the cataloging department of a very small academic library. I happened to open a cabinet looking for paper and found a whole shelf of books on sex, including The Joy of Sex when it was new, you know. And so I asked the cataloger sitting there, why are these books back here in this cabinet? And she said, we don't feel appropriate to put those on the open shelf, but they are accessible. A student can ask me and I will get the one. And I said, how many freshmen have you had to ask you for one of those books? We also, as a research university like the University of Pittsburgh and McGill, we are trying to collect materials from all over the world. And sometimes this is very, very difficult because in some of the areas of the world, as you've heard, academic freedom is not a valid concept, really. I know, for example, I had a librarian arrested in China because he was bringing materials out of China that related to the Cultural Revolution that he had found in the remote places and made copies of. And of course, he was held in jail for months and months. We worked very hard and finally were able to get him released, but the material never made it out of China. I'm collecting material right now from North Korea, but I'm doing it through a Chinese university on the border surreptitiously. People in North Korea have no idea they're building a collection at the University of Pittsburgh. So we are trustees in a way of knowledge, and we must work very hard to be free of bias and also push toward opening of other parts of the world We are a publisher at the University of Pittsburgh. I publish 60 journals, by the way. 55 of those are open access journals. And I have editors and journals from many parts of the world that we are hosting free of charge, trying to promote this whole idea of open access. My other message to you today, is that libraries are changing in fundamental ways. And if you look at a library in the 19th century, in the 20th century, in the 21st century, you see they were mostly the same for hundreds of years. And suddenly libraries are changing in rather dramatic ways. And I would conjecture that in the next 10 or 20 years, you would not recognize the library on your university as what it is, being what it is today. We have to explode the library from the walls of buildings, from the shelves of print collections, and push it in to where everybody is doing their research and writing, and because they're doing this in very new ways. So I could speak about that, and I often do, for a very lengthy time. But I think I'll just conclude by saying I agree that academic freedom is a disruption in a way to us who are administrators. It's kind of a nuisance to have people disagree with you and do it openly and have total freedom to do so. But it is a price we pay for being in the academy. I work very hard in my librarians at Pitt and in other places where I've been to build faculty governance, librarian governance into the system so that everyone has an opportunity to participate fully in developing the charting the courses that we take. But at the end of the day, there's also this thing that if you're going to get a boat down the river to the place where you're trying to go, if every paddle is splashing in a different direction, you're not really ever going to make it there. So we try to build consensus and then work together. That's worked well for me. So I'll leave you with that note and come back later.
Thank you, Russ. Michael.
Thank you. Well, I'm actually an administrator, but a university professor as well, and I'm used to 90-minute periods, so this is a challenge, 7 minutes. What I'm going to do is four things. Introduce myself, and by that I mean provide a little context, raise some questions that I think are important here today, though provide no answers of any kind, identify some issues that haven't yet surfaced or have not directly surfaced, and then identify some challenges that I think we should all address. So first, let me tell you that I am by no means an expert on the area of academic freedom, and I have no legal training. I was invited to participate, I think, because I run an organization that works in an area where we move academics around, and we face a unique series of challenges, largely relating to whether academic freedom is, in fact, portable. And under what circumstances do we define academic freedom when we have a person from one country spending a significant amount of time in another country? And I think because our concerns are not unlike the university's concerns. We have a number of partners. We take money from the United States government. We take money from the Canadian government. We take money from 141 other governments. We have private sector partners. In fact, we are a public sector, private sector partnership. I'm fond of saying that the United States government believes that I work for them. The Canadian government believes that I work for them.
So you work for yourself.
My private sector partners actually know better, but they'd like me to say what they'd like me to say, and they'd like to believe that I work for them. Indeed, I have a personal services contract to a board of directors where I have an unlimited amount of freedom to get in trouble, which I do with great regularity. The program, and I'm a political science professor, so of course we're always getting in trouble. Never admit you're a political science professor at a cocktail party, especially during election season, which in North America is always. I also lived and worked and taught in countries where they have a very different conception of academic freedom than we have here. I taught at Kokusu Daigaku in Japan, the International University of Japan, which is started as a joint Dartmouth IUJ program, and we had very, very significant difficulties with respect to American and Canadian scholars and what they believed was appropriate and not appropriate. I also, and apropos of yesterday's comments by Pericles Lewis, I was in Singapore the day the gum law was passed some years ago. It was a pivotal moment in just general freedom everywhere, and I will never forget, if I live for 1,000 years, the Clarets people took out an ad in the local paper. On the left-hand side of the page, it had a picture of gum and an X through it and said, "You simply cannot chew anymore." On the right-hand side of the page was a Clarets lozenge, and it said, "But you still suck." There are ways to express opinions that make it clear to the audience what you're saying, even in a place like Singapore, where at the time, and indeed still now, there are level of authoritarianism is much higher than we're accustomed to. So let me identify my questions. First, what is the definition of academic freedom, and is it portable? If we're talking about scholars working in two countries, do we apply those academic freedoms from their home institution, or do we look at some amended or national or local version of those freedoms? What exactly are we protecting? Speech, practice, actions, pedagogy. Most people in Canada will know the famous Denis Rancourt case, where the issue, in fact, was about not what he was saying, but how he was grading his students. In fact, if any of you know the case, it's quite interesting. He simply gave every student in his class an A+, because he didn't believe that the model of grading suited his pedagogical views. Was eventually fired by the University of Ottawa, and it has been quite a celebrated case. Who are we protecting? Faculty, students, people on campus? Is tenure an issue? Because if it is, there are very dramatic changes. In this country, tenured faculty went from, roughly 79.8% in 1980 to about 70% last year. But in the United States, tenured faculty has dropped from 55% in the mid-1970s to 29% last year. Tenure, if it is the guarantee we think it is, certainly is available to less than half the community in the United States and a decreasing share in Canada. Issues. Is technology a game changer? When we take money from donors, to what extent does that matter? And I've heard over the last 2 days much discussion about public universities. As everybody in this room must know, public universities get some share of their money from public sources. I want to use a university where I spend a significant amount of time, and that's Berkeley. They are down to 19%. 19% of the university's operating budget comes from public sources. It is one of the world's great public universities. The only small problem is that it is not public. So, 1 minute. Bottom line, I do agree with Pericles Lewis, I value engagement. We're never going to actually move ahead unless we engage and we are in places doing things actively, thoughtfully, and aggressively. But the reality is that criticism is mission critical to the modern university, and that our role, our job, our responsibility is to promote an open, thoughtful, critical environment. How do we do that, though, with changing funding formulas, with the reality of authoritarian governments in places where we want to and should operate, with the internationalization challenge that Professor Nelson spoke about, with the realities of donors who are not always at arm's length in this country? We have examples recently, Mr. Balsillie in Waterloo, who would like to play a bigger role in the world. And finally, thank you. And finally, the pressure for various universities to actually provide skilled labor as opposed to providing educated persons, which I think is what we're supposed to be doing. Thank you.
Thank you. Please film it. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Perhaps many of you be asking yourself, what is a Cuban doing here? But I really appreciate the opportunity the organizing committee gave me, inviting me to participate here. The Cuban educational system is universal, free, accessible. It provides full access, and it is integral. In 1959, just three universities existed in Cuba, with barely 15,000 university students. In fact, there was so much autonomy in these institutions that each of them were a separate island. Today, we have more than 600,000 university students, and we have universities in each of the 15 provinces of the country. But we have organized a real system, a network of universities in Cuba. Considering what was stated in the World Conference of Higher Education in 2009, in the final report, they said, higher education institutions made tasks, research, teaching, and service to the community, carried out in the context of institutional autonomy and academic freedom, should increase their interdisciplinary focus and promote critical thinking and active citizenship. This could contribute to sustainable development, peace, well-being, and the realization of human rights, including gender equity. As stated here, the main task of the Cuban university professors today is forming future professionals fully committed to the aim of achieving a better world with the moral values which correspond to a dignified, supportive human being committed to solidarity. Our priority is to move forward in the perfection of the education of the new generations of Cuban professionals to foster academic excellency of Cuban universities measured through their social pertinence. Committed, competent, and responsible performance of faculty and researchers in the formation of the new professionals aim at solving the problems faced by the current socio-economic development of our country. And I emphasize this as one of the main challenges a Cuban faculty meets in his or her job. Meeting standards of excellence in the training of new professionals is an imperative which obliges us to make rational use of the resources available to institutions and commit to the participation of the best researchers and professionals in that exercise. It is in this commitment that our academic freedom lies, also in overcoming the challenges faced by the Cuban society today, economic problems, a scarcity or total lack of resources, and partial isolation for the rest of the world. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's perfect. That's perfect. So now the beauty and, of course, the challenge is that our speakers, in sticking to their time, raised many different issues. And so you could map the things we've heard in a number of different ways. There seem to be some important distinctions all sort of coming to us under the banner of academic freedom. And I thought I would just very briefly spell out a couple of the distinctions that I sense in the conversation, and it might help us sort of clarify in the interventions what part of the issues raised people might be speaking about. It seems to me that a number of the speakers have raised the question of academic freedom at home, in McGill, in a North American university, versus in some other setting. There have been distinctions drawn between academic freedom as a researcher, as a teacher, and then the academic freedom to criticize one's institution, for example. That's a different kind, perhaps, of academic freedom. And then Natalie, in particular, distinguished the formal recognition or definition of rights. If you only put academic freedom down in a document, what would you put? She distinguished that from the sort of institutional carrying out the on-the-ground reality, which also includes the impact not only on the particular speaker, but on her community around her, so the impacts on the wider network of people. It seems to me that those are at least some of the distinctions. My proposal, given how big the crowd is this afternoon and how limited the time, I'm going to take comments or questions in little clusters of two or three, and then the panelists will respond. Obviously, they should feel no obligation to respond to each one of the questions. Please come to the microphone if you have something to say, and we'll continue this conversation. Okay, first.
Thank you very much. My name is Muhammad Ahmed. I am from the Institute of Islamic Studies at McGill. I would like to pose my question maybe to Professor Rosier. Basically, I think it's my feeling that academic freedom is a personal tool for every professor who's teaching. It is something more than just that teachers should have it, but it is, I cannot perform my duties, I mean, I cannot stand in front of my students if I don't have all of my tools. And this is one of those to me. So I would like to hear more about this one, that how we can, I mean, regardless of we have statement or we don't have statement, we have law, we don't have, but how we can feel comfortable that my tools are, I'm equipped with my tools. And this is one of the most important for me. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And John Stern will, his, and then we'll go to answers.
Thanks for the panel. I have questions for Natalie DeRosier and Rush Miller. Natalie, you said, correct me if I'm wrong, academic freedom must cover more than freedom of speech. I'd like to hear about the more part. And also things that you think institutions should do sort of positively and explicitly to fight the chill and the chilling effects that, you know, implicit prior restraint can be. And then, Rush Miller, I'm interested in two things. One is how you see academic freedom for librarians as academics, as scholars. And then also, because of course it's a dual position, right? It's a little different than other kinds of people on the tenure track or whatever. And then also sort of how that relates to pushing back against institutional and informational imperatives that may in fact be at odds with the intellectual mission of the library. I think of things like eBrary, which is, as a, you know, digitizing books sounds great. Unfortunately, they're much harder to read if you read books. And it's very different than articles. And I think eBrary is a classic case of a failure in this case. So I'll leave it there.
Thank you.
So I could not agree more that indeed freedom is a tool of teaching, it's a tool of research. It's impossible, I think, to inspire critical thinking in your student if you don't use it and if you're not it, you know? So in my view, that's the reason why academic freedom is not a luxury, it is essential, but we have to be serious about it, you know? And that, I think, was the point of my talk, is that once you say you give it to your teachers, they have it anyway, you know, but how do you actualize it? How do you make sure that indeed there is not a chill? And so that brings me to the second type of the questions by Jonathan Stern, which was, I do think that you... That freedom of speech does not exist in isolation. You know, you have to have due process to ensure that you have freedom of speech. You have to have freedom of association to have freedom of speech. So, in my world, and was trying to examine, is if we are serious about saying academic freedom is what makes a university innovative, that it's a duty, because otherwise, and I had a great quote from J.F. Kennedy saying, you know, conformity is what actually negates progress, you know, so essential to the academic mission would be practicing the muscle of freedom. And I think in that sense, you would want to have all the above, you know, freedom of association, participatory rights, due process that ensure that you are indeed protected to be an individual. I actually also think that we have to look seriously at the culture of an institution to see whether the chill is there. You know, the chill is experienced not only when people is officially disciplined, but when indeed around that person obviously academic freedom of speech doesn't mean you don't lose friends when you say something stupid, you know, but it must mean that at least institutionally you have the reflex not to impose a consequences more or less well imagined, you know. So I think you have to be careful about looking at yourselves seriously about how is it that we manage disagreement and so on. So, I mean, the response is always more speech, not less.
That's the motto of people that believe in freedom of speech, is it's better to talk it out than silence it.
I didn't have time to talk about librarians as faculty, but I wanted to. About 50% of academic librarians in the United States have a status that you would roughly consider faculty. Not all have faculty titles. Not all have tenure. I've directed four libraries in my career. All four had some form of faculty status, including the one I'm in now. And that meant that they were organized and treated as faculty. They served in the Senate. They had similar kinds of responsibilities for teaching, research, and service, although research is de-emphasized among librarians, I think, for most part, and service may be more emphasized. I would say that, you know, speaking as a historian who's a librarian, who has been both a faculty member and a librarian, that it's not exactly right to say that librarians are true faculty and have all the rights, responsibilities that teaching faculty or research faculty actually enjoy. But they do have enough of that status to be part of the academy, to participate in faculty governance, and have the expectation within the library that there's indeed a faculty governance system in place, as there is in the whole university. Where they do not have faculty status in the other half, and that would include institutions like Harvard, for example, they are staff. They're considered staff. And so I'm not sure how the issue of academic freedom plays out at a place like Harvard when your librarians are not considered part of the faculty. And the academic freedom really doesn't apply in the same way that it would in a faculty environment. But I think a lot of my practical experience within libraries is that where this comes to play in terms of academic freedom most often is in the relationship between the administrator or the director or what a dean or whatever and the librarians in terms of collaborative thinking and consensus building and working together as opposed to being in possible conflict. The other thing, though, it's very complicated. There's one part of me that would say, okay, let's all stand up and rail against the publishing world that's publishing e-books because some of our people don't like to read them. And let's insist on maintaining these large book collections. And we'll go down with that ship because, frankly, in 10 years, that ship will be down underwater. As a person who's watched this and been involved in technology now for a long, long time, e-books are outstripping print books in the marketplace, which is all that really matters. And I, as a librarian, and you as a faculty member, cannot, in fact, stop the march toward e-books as the preferred format of book literature. We may not prefer it. Our students may not even prefer it. But the economics of publishing and selling books is that already some forms of book publishing has gone predominantly e-book. And as with journals, and I guess I'll relate this back to the mid-90s when I had a lot of faculty on my campus saying, oh, Lord, don't get electronic journals. We have to have the print because, you know, you can't guarantee the electronic will be there. So today I have 97,000 journals at Pitt. And 1,000 are in print. And I suspect in 5 years I'll have zero in print. Not only do we get electronic journals, we don't get print journals anymore. And not only are people accepting that now, they prefer that because they want the library on their desktop, not in a building across campus. And I know that in some disciplines it's slower to come than in others, but very frankly, I've seen all kinds of analyses worldwide, surveys, and the data is overwhelming. 80% of faculty in this world start their search outside the library. Almost all students do, In fact, the survey doesn't even register a percent for students using the library. And there are 20 other things ahead of that. And their number one thing, of course, is the search engine. And I have humanist faculty telling me almost every day, oh, the Google Scholar is my new library. So my goal in the future is to get Google Scholar populated with the content that I'm trying to deliver faculty, because that's how they're getting to it. So it's an interesting debate, it's an interesting question, but my view is we shouldn't be fighting that. We should be trying to mold that and build services around it, and hopefully that's what we're doing.
Thank you. Next. Darren, are you at the microphone? Yeah.
Yeah, I thought there maybe was someone over there. No. Darren Marty, Communication Studies. I have two questions for Natalie Desrosiers. The first is that you said in your remarks that if there are to be limitations on academic freedom, the threshold of justification has to be very, very high. And so my question to you is, in your experience with the CCLA over the last few years, would you say that in Canada, in general, the threshold for limitation is where it's supposed to be, and is there a trend? Is it lowering in what you've seen, or is it going the other way? That's my first question. My second question pertains to university campuses as kind of special zones for the incubation of social change. I know the CCLA has in the past been a strong champion of the idea that universities' campuses have to have special protection because of their historic role as places where opinions, ideas, ways of being, identities that might historically be marginalized from time to time have a kind of free space in which to flourish without fear. I'd like to ask you about, if you could say something about the relationship of academic freedom to that role that universities play. Typically, when we discuss academic freedom in relation to that, we say, well, academic freedom is not about protecting political activism, and we're kind of done with that. But I think the relationship might be a little more complex than that, something along the lines of, you know, a university or university system that has very strong protection for academic freedom, a very high threshold, right, will also be a kind of university system that provides a wide berth for that other kind of expression, activism, experimentation, etc., even if academic freedom formally does not protect that kind of activity. And that, by contrast, of course, a setting in which academic freedom is increasingly curtailed is also more likely to be a setting in which these other kinds of civil liberties experience the kind of chill that you described. Would you characterize the relationship in something like those terms?
Yeah, well, thank you for the question. Actually, it reminds me of something that I did not add to my list of more than freedom of speech is needed to be a free academic, and its privacy protection as well, because I think one of the issue may very well be that there's some need of protection of privacy to experiment with bold and new ideas. You know, there's a link demonstrated often between innovation and the possibility of privacy. So let me, first the question is the threshold high enough? Well, certainly I think CCLA is in the business of making it higher, but to be a little bit more concrete here, is when we're talking about the high threshold, we're demanding of the institution decision maker who's trying to impose limits, either prior restraints, which are usually the ones that we are particularly concerned about, that they do so in the following way. When they have, it has to be in advance, so people are not caught off guard, so it has to be written, or, you know, it has to be for an objective that is of significant importance. It cannot just be because, well, there's going to be a little bit of disturbance. It has to be that there is a serious issue of safety involved. It has to be as little as possible. That is absolutely necessary. And there has to be some mechanism of testing whether or not all these conditions listed above are met. So you need a governance issue. There's a governance issue here as to how this is done. and the way in which you absolutely want to demand a high threshold. And I am serious when I say the university have to practice being better than municipal councils or others who issue trespass when people disagree with them constantly. Well, university have to be the model in that respect about what does it mean to engage in public decision making in a way that, you know, obviously will be criticized. That's the value of a democracy. So there's a way in which we teach students how to become decision makers in the future by the way in which we are organized. You know, if you don't want to raise dictators, don't be a dictator. You know, would be a, it doesn't apply to my children. But so that's what's my point. Now the interaction I think that you wanted to, me to make with you know, how do we ensure that there would be some sort of connections between the space, creating the space, and CCLA continues to do that. We write letters all the time to say, before an administration or anyone in university decide to exclude someone from attending, from being there, the repercussions are bigger than just on that event. Yes, it will be more peaceful that night, but the repercussions are about the very essence of what a university is. So I think it's in that context that we demand a very high commitment. It's hard. We're demanding a really... it's hard to be a university administrator. I was one, but, you know, certainly there's a lot of things I say now that I say, geez, you know, there are things that I could have done differently. But I think it's very important to have a voice that say we deserve better. We absolutely deserve to make the thing. And I think there is, for me, a real, I think academic freedom, if you define it too narrowly, and I don't care. Everybody, you know, who owns the definition? Who does? If you want freedom, and it has to be not, it has to be freedom of expression broadly defined, it also has to include the protection of the freedom of students and the controversial ways, views expressed on campus. Otherwise, ça sert à rien. You know, it's not going to be useful to society. So to me, it would be impossible to preach among ourselves for academic freedom and not extend it to other people.
Someone's moved the microphone. Yes.
Okay, so I'm Renee Sieber, joint between geography and the School of Environment. And I want you to reflect, get your opinions on the word progress. I mean, progress is often, it's a really funny word. It's often positive as this inexorable freight train that we have to respond to or else. And it doesn't always coincide or align with fundamental rights that are, whatever they are, that are much more static. So I wonder if you could reflect on this need to always adapt, respond to resource crises, et cetera, in the face of having to recognize established principles of academic freedom.
That was for any of you, I believe. If you haven't, go ahead.
Yes, Dora.
Well, what your question evoked for me, and I hope I understood it well, was in my speech I had a part about how the reason why I think we may be having this discussion on academic freedom now is because there is, whether we want it or not, we feel a sense of threat. And it's a threat that is not only university generated. It's a larger threat, which I would say is, I think, the threat that I see in my world, which is that more and more, because we have invested a lot in prevention, in risk analysis, and so on, all great things, it has moved us in, you know, reacting before somebody does something. Okay, so we're going to arrest, detain, and prevent somebody before they've done anything, because we now, you know, manage risk better. And that's the world out there. And it's normal, obviously, that this world, this impetus, certainly the insurance company want this impetus to be shared generally, in a way, when you're talking about freedom of expression, academic freedom, the freedom of scholars, the freedom of, to explore fully, you're asking the university to be à contre-courant, to not react on the preventative model, but indeed to be stopping itself from engaging with it. So I don't know whether that helps you on the reflection. Who knows whether that's progress or not, but certainly I think that would be one of my reflections.
The question is fascinating. I'm not sure I fully understand what it is you want to get at, but progress in its very simplest definition means to move forward. We're moving forward. Whether we like it, whether the implications of moving forward are good or bad, we're moving forward. The problem, and I couldn't agree more with Natalie, the problem is over the last couple of decades, we're increasingly unable to contain these discussions, debates, and challenges within the context of a room like this, or a university like this, or a city like this. Yesterday's lecture reminded us that Yale's going to open a campus in Singapore, or someone's going to open a campus in Singapore. So those bundle of authority relationships and challenges are going to have to be addressed. Whether you address them, or I address them, or Yale addresses them, someone is. We also, and the word technology has come up two or three times this afternoon, we also really haven't talked about the fact that technology simply allows things to be said to a larger number of people in a more careless way and with greater speed. Well, it's not speed, it's the physical volume of the things that are said. So the challenges are sort of cascading at us. I was at Berkeley today, President Bergeneau allowed the police to come on campus, the Metro Police, as opposed to having the Berkeley police deal with the Occupy movement. This was an academic freedom issue. I suspect he should have let someone else look after this. I suspect at Berkeley they shouldn't have let the Metro Police on campus. But this was one of those things, again, where all of a sudden it looked like something was happening. What do you do? We don't have the time or the opportunity to dissect every decision the way academics like to. I was on a plane a long time ago, but it has always stuck with me. And the guy sitting beside me was Charles Krauthammer. He asked me what I did. I told him. He said, "Too bad for you." And I said, "Really?" I'm a professor of international politics. He said, "The world is changing more quickly than you have time to schedule seminars to discuss it." That's the problem with progress. The world is changing more quickly than we have time to schedule seminars to discuss it.
That's certainly true in libraries. We sat back in our ivory tower and decided we're not going to address that change in user behavior or this change in user behavior or this new development in technology. We could become one of the great museum cultures of the world.
We're going to go to Mark and then Carrie.
Mark Bouchard from the libraries. This is more of a comment than a question. And here this is in response to what Professor Sieber was saying about progress. As many people here know, one of the events which ultimately prompted the holding of this conference is that some time ago, I believe about a year ago, the Association of Universities and Colleges in Canada, which had a statement on academic freedom, adopted a new version of it. And one of the most striking comments that I've heard about this new statement is a comment that I heard at the last council meeting of CAUT, which was held, I believe, last spring. And the new AUCC statement was discussed. And the comment that was made was that there is no question that the new statement is a throwback to an earlier model of academic freedom. The only point of debate is whether the new statement throws us back 50 years or 100 years. So I guess the point that this was making, which ties into what Professor Sieber said, is that progress is not necessarily constant, and progress is, in fact, not necessarily irreversible.
Mm-hmm. Carrie, please.
I thought since it's come up, maybe I should just say a couple other things about the differences between the external and internal effects of academic freedom, and I suspect one or more of you can confirm or disconfirm. One of the basic principles is academic freedom cannot protect you from punishments by the state if you violate state law, but it should protect you from punishments by the university when you're penalized for actions in the public sphere. In other words, one of the fundamental concepts of academic freedom is opposition to double jeopardy. The state punishes you, the university doesn't pile it on. Now, across the world, by no means do all universities honor that principle, but I think in Canada and the United States, we can do our best to honor that kind of principle. And I'd go a little further in saying that I think there are occasions when institutional autonomy and faculty academic freedom should give the institution and the faculty collectively and individually the power to object to state law and declare it to be fundamentally unethical, immoral, or what other. Think of the anti-miscegenation laws in the American South that obtained for quite a while. One would not want to have seen a Southern university fire a faculty member for interracial marriage or advocating interracial marriage. So there are times when I think the university really needs to stand against the power of the state. An example in my own experience, I not long ago defended an Israeli faculty member for advocating a boycott in the state of Israel. But I decided to push things a little further because there were administrators, including the president of his own college, that said he had basically violated tenure by advocating that, right, which I opposed that interpretation. But I went a little further and I said one of the ultimate tests for academic freedom within a nation state should be that a faculty member has the right to say that his or her own nation state has no moral legitimacy to exist. That is, to oppose the very rights of the nation state to be a legal entity. Now, you might get in trouble with the external authorities, though in many places you could say that. I'm not certain whether you can still say it in the United States after the Patriot Act, but the university should not pile on and provide double jeopardy in a case like that. Academic freedom has to protect one's external actions and utterances in that way. Some of you may have examples of countries that don't exactly fulfill that.
Thank you. We have 2 minutes, so I'm not asking for sort of full closing statements, but if there are brief final comments from any of the panelists, we have time for that.
I want to just say one thing about that. And librarians in the United States have fought very hard against the Patriot Act because, as you know, and continue to fight that because, even in the renewal of it, because libraries are a special target of the Patriot Act. Mm-hmm. They have the right now to come into a library and take circulation records and search through them. Now, my solution to that, by the way, I'm a passive-aggressive person sometimes, is that our system does not retain any of that information at all. And even though the system would allow us to retain it, we simply don't retain it more than a day or two after the book is due or is returned. So we told them when they came to us, and they did a few years ago, we said, I'm sorry, we would love to give it to you, but we don't have it to give to you. And sent them away. And so the subpoena is not effective when there's no information to be retrieved like that. But this is really a serious issue in terms of, it goes back to your issue of privacy. Mm-hmm. People, it's a chilling thing when anyone who's using a research university library to do research can be exposed for what they're using. Just think about that in terms of academic freedom.
I'd like you to join me, please, in thanking the panelists for panel one.
And to thank Robert for so ably moderating it.